It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about the notion that the natural sciences are concerned with the physical and the measurable, while art, on the other hand, is thought to deal mostly with human feelings, ideas, and making connections. However, our guest is going to take us through how wild life rehabilitation is not so simply defined as one or the other of those. It effectively combines aspects of veterinary medicine, animal husbandry, animal behavior, intuition, and the ability to see things on a larger scale. And with us today is a guest that we've had on before, Franny Greenberg, who's a licensed wildlife rehabilitator and educator at the Millstone Wildlife Center in Windham, New Hampshire. Welcome, Franny.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
So, you know, what's amazing to me is I know that one of your goals is not just to the health of the animal that you take in, but it extends beyond that. And can you describe a little bit about what are the goals of a rehabilitator? What how's that vary from, you know, like somebody who has a pet who needs to have it cared for?
As a wildlife rehabilitator, of course, the end result, we would always like this animal to be back in the wild. But from the day they're brought in until the day of release, there's many things that need to happen. And initially, we're worried about the obvious. Is this animal healthy? What do we need to do to care for it as far as nutrition goes? But over the long range, and some animals are with us 6 months, maybe a year. It really depends on the species and the need of the animal. During that time, we're really looking at more than just the physical health of this animal. We're looking at the emotional health as well.
Wow. So how do you... We're not talking about cats and dogs here. We're talking about animals that live in the wild. How do you understand or even begin to get at the emotional side of an animal that's a wild animal?
I think intuition plays a big role. Listening, taking time to observe animal behavior and really sitting quietly with these animals sometimes helps you know, is this animal stressed? Is this animal enjoying what you're offering? Because it is more than just, do you like the meal we're serving? It's not just about that. Are your days preparing you to be free? If you come in as an orphan, you need to have the skills that mom would have taught you. Sometimes that means we are teaching an animal, whether it be how to swim or that there are blueberries on certain bushes. And sometimes it's just offering those experiences without needing to teach, but preparing them so that when they're wild, they are ready to be without a human, without a center, and we can be confident that they're ready to bring.
So when you bring an animal in, or someone brings an animal to you and you take it in, you've got an initial kind of triage, right? You've got an assessment that you have to do. Find out, is this even something right before you even take it in, right? I mean, is this really something that you can take care of? Because your idea is not just to give them a life that would be where they just are living out their life with you, but the whole goal is, again, reintroducing.
That's right. And that's where we began. And unfortunately, sometimes the animals that come to us are really not able to be rehabilitated. And we make what is sometimes a difficult decision to euthanize when we feel that is best. And euthanasia means a good death. So we feel sometimes that is the best option. We don't want any of our animals to suffer. We want them to really be healthy and be able to go through rehab to be free. We do at times keep some that are healthy but unable to be set free. We do use those as program animals, but primarily we're looking to set everyone back in the wild.
Yeah, and so that also is how you can handle so many animals, because you've got to, if you kept collecting them all and keeping them, you become like a big zoo or something. So you are like a big zoo, but what I mean is you have a cycling.
That is very true. Although, we enjoy each season, we know at the end of the season they will be free, the cages will open up, and more will come. So we are not in the business of collecting animals. We really want them to be out, and sometimes a different species is in that cage, sometimes the same species, but we cycle through, and that's how we did almost 1,000 animals here last year.
Wow. And so you have to do a fair amount of understanding the kind of ideas about the science and natural settings and the environment. So you have to pretty well understand, which with your background, I'm sure you've got some of that. But on the other hand, you have to also go beyond that into almost the medical science of it or veterinary science of it. So explain, how do you balance all that learning?
Well, it's lifelong learning, and every day we are learning something new, whether it's research, if someone has done some work helping to figure out how to help Eastern cottontails who tend to stress and not do well in rehab. There are people out there that are trying every day to come up with new means to get them out the door. So whether it's that, whether it's research, or whether it's our own work, and again, sitting quietly with an animal, sometimes you learn a lot about the species. Not that we want to have them near humans, but sometimes as you are feeding, as you are learning about their habitat, as you are designing habitats, you really learn a lot about their natural history, about what they need, about what works well, which animals are successful when they seem to do better. Sometimes you have to read stress, and in animals, one animal may show it very differently than another. So there is the animal science, the veterinary science, there is just that, the psychology behind it all. It's a little bit of everything all rolled into one.
When you have, and I would think that the range of animals that you have must be pretty amazing. So can you help us understand the range of animals that you can actually provide service for?
Sure. We do tiny little animals. We have a tiny little shrew that's here right now. And of course, that does not need a big space. We have little bitty containers. We have incubators in all sizes. Right now, we have a coyote. And although it's a pup, that will at one point graduate from being in a small space to larger and larger, so we can get her ready to be released. So we really do a wide range of sizes, a wide range of species. We don't do bear. We don't have that space here, that capacity. We don't do deer. They have very different needs. But beyond that, we do mammals, not birds. And it changes depending on the season. We find June is the month where we see a lot of skunks. Woodchucks are coming now, so you can predict a little bit about what is coming your way when we can look back last year and say, all right, May and June were our busiest months. When do we get our squirrels? You can see the cycle of rabbits. They have 6 or 7 litters a year, and they all are cycling fairly similarly. So when we get a call about a rabbit, if we have some, we can expect they're likely to be the same size. So mom rabbits out there are all cycling together, as are the woodchucks. So we have many different animals. Right now we have 120 plus animals. It changes every day. Sometimes that's because we've accepted new animals. Unfortunately, not all those animals make it. We have animals that we either, as we talked about, either euthanasia is the best option, or they simply pass. We have animals that come with severe injuries, and sometimes they don't make it beyond triage.
So you have all mammals, so that helps define it a little bit, although there's a lot of mammals in that category. So no fish, no birds, no reptiles.
Right.
So you're not dealing with snakes. And all those anatomies and physiologies are very different. They are within what you have, but extremely different when you get outside of that. And you also don't have the really, really large animals. But I wonder, do a lot of them or most of them come because of their interactions with humans? So are they injured because of something that's happened in the habitat or a car or trap or what, or it's some of it naturally that they come?
The human is a very large component. And whether that be people have found an animal in their shed, we get many of our raccoons, and we have 18 babies right now because someone has found that adult, and they don't realize this time of year that that mommy is probably upset and making those noises in your shed because she's protecting her young. Very often what happens is that person will trap and remove or get someone to dispatch that animal. And lo and behold, a day or two later, you find out why they're a baby. So we get a lot of those animals from human interaction. We also get a lot of animals from interaction with domestics. So the cat that you let out, the dog that's out, they're doing what's natural to them, but they find and injure, unfortunately, many little mammals.
Yeah, and we keep our cat in, which is hard for sometimes for people to do, but when she has been out, if she escapes, she is a really perfect predator. And the thing that people don't realize, I think, and you would know this part, but a lot of times, even though she may not kill the animal, just the fact of the trauma and the way that animal tries to pull away and tears in the skin may lead to infection and eventually death anyway.
Unfortunately. And we have calls, people say, well, my cat dropped it. It's fine. I don't see wounds. But a tiny little puncture hole through the skin is enough sometimes to cause death because a cat's mouth is filled with germs. So we treat in that instance with an antibiotic. And as you mentioned, the rips in the skin, some animals are just, that's their anatomy. So if you get a hold of a rabbit, you very often the rabbit can pull away to save its life. But what happens is you have something called degloving. So you have a major part of the skin that's now exposed with the fur gone or the outer layers of skin.
Yeah, and then that's exposed to the environment to, obviously, it gets exposed to bacteria and other things. And that can be, so even though you may have a bird that your cat caught and it flies off, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's okay.
Exactly right.
So, yeah, I think, I think that's, again, a reason that we try to keep them in. I always get concerned when somebody puts in a lot of bird feeders and then they have cats that are out too. I always feel like that's, they're actually creating bait for the, trapping them. When you just mentioned something that I think is really interesting, and that's the idea of that you have to provide antibiotics and all that. What's your relationship with veterinarians? How are you able to do that?
That's a critical component as a rehabilitator, because I am not a veterinarian, so I can't write my own prescriptions. We work with veterinarians in and around the area. We have a vet of record because I am licensed. I have to have one person willing to sign and say, yes, I will talk to her when she needs it. But we do have other veterinarians as well. We have two others that come on a regular basis. They come to me and they're here happy to clean a cage. It's not just to offer medical advice. But the wonderful thing about that is that they're on site while they're here feeding a baby or cleaning something, I can at that point say, can you lay another pair of eyes on an animal? So it's not just me. I have a veterinarian who can say, yes, I agree. And I can also offer you a prescription for that, because we do in fact need antibiotics and dewormers and vaccines. So we do have a need for veterinarians to work with us.
Yeah. And when it comes to euthanasia, are you permitted to do that? Or again, does that have to be done with a veterinarian?
So we rely on others for that, although there are certain things we can't do here. We're not allowed to have an injectable that we could euthanize with. And depending on the size, we can either go to a veterinarian, we can have them dispatched through Fish and Game or an animal control officer. We do have access to CO chambers and we have different
really
means.
Small, yeah. The same as a veterinarian would also have, you know.
Right.
Are these mostly small animal vets then that come and volunteer and work with you?
Yes. Yes. And most of them don't have a wildlife background. They just have an interest. We have one vet who worked in a zoo when he was just starting out. So he's got some exotic information that he, but a lot of the information is the same. If you are treating a wound, it doesn't matter if it's a cat, a dog, or an opossum.
That's true. And a lot of that would be. So wounds come from, obviously, your domestic cat, but they can also come from being just hit by a car, it could be that somebody maliciously did something.
Yes.
That was happened.
And even the animal, we find juvenile animals make bad choices, like sometimes juvenile humans. They are getting themselves stuck places they shouldn't have been. We find animals in dumpsters trying to get out of little holes that they don't fit out of. So there are many ways that they come in with wounds, not just the domestics, but also interactions with animals that are the same species. When you're learning to figure out who is top dog or top raccoon, sometimes there's an injury involved. Or if you come in contact with, you know, a bigger, larger predator, you sometimes come away with a wound.
Yes, that totally makes sense. It was funny, the other day I was looking out and from in the basement through one of the wells, and there was a little bunny that had gotten down in there. It couldn't get out, but I don't know how long it had been there, but I could see it through the window. I wouldn't have seen it otherwise. But I helped it out, and it seemed okay. But the issue would have been if it stayed in there too long, it would have had no food, no water, and it would have been really hot in there over time too. So again, I guess we can find things around our house where they just stumble, like you said, they stumble into something and they can't get themselves out of something.
Right.
Wow. When people bring things to you, do they just bring them to you? Do they know that you're there? Do they call you ahead of time? How do you manage?
The goal is that we have people call. We work from our homes, so we don't have hours. I always tell people if I'm awake, we're open. So we're open many, many hours a day. And we hope they will call. My fear is someone will come and put an animal on my front doorstep, not tell me, and that animal is outside and it needs to be there. So I answer my phone. That is something I feel very, very strongly about. The only time I do not answer is if I am juggling two calls and a porcupine, but I will still call right back. I feel we save as many animals by answering the phone as we do by bringing those animals into care. Sometimes the individual needs to know to leave that animal where it is. Sometimes they need to know what not to do, what to eat food or no water. So it's really important that I pick up that phone and I do my best, or I will have my husband answer when I'm doing things like this. And somebody is answering the phone. People let us know they're coming. Occasionally they will stop by and we, of course, will answer the door, but the goal is to know you're coming. That way, I'm ready with an incubator. I'm ready with whatever it is I need on my end, and we can care for the animal.
So how many staff do you actually have between volunteers and paid staff? How many people? Because that's a lot of animals.
Yeah, we are a 501c3. We're a 100% volunteer organization. That means I'm not paid. I have no paid staff. everyone from veterinarian to the dishwasher that comes weekly is unpaid. This is all a labor of love. We have many volunteers. We have many people who come and give up their time in different ways. I have people who don't necessarily want to feed an animal, but have offered to come and build a cage. Or someone who says, I'll take a load of laundry home every week to help you that way. And then, of course, we have many people who come and actually do hand feed and learn how to help with wounds or picking parasites off of an animal. So all aspects of it. This summer, we have 7 part-time interns from colleges around the area, not just New Hampshire. We have them from multiple states. And our regular volunteers number about 30 right now. And we have them 7 days a week, starting 8 a.m. I have people that are here till 10 o'clock if they need to stay later, one night a week. We know our volunteer who is diligent and will make things shine. We'll be here till midnight.
That's just, you know, an amazing effort on the part of everyone, especially you and your husband and family. That is hard. Rewarding, but it is difficult. But also, it's an amazing effort that people really want to be supportive where they can with the skills that they have. So that's another way that you're using your intuition. You have to read when somebody wants to volunteer and help. You're having to read sort of, well, where might they be good at, when what might be they be good at? And then, of course, you're watching them and observing them. But wow, that's a whole other skill that you have to have.
We do work a lot with people, not just the volunteers, but with those finders as well, because emotions run high. When you have found an animal and you have a relationship, even if it's just for an hour, there's a lot of work that we do with those people. And sometimes they don't want to surrender their animal. So yes, it's working with people that are volunteers, working with people that are the finders, and animals are our mission. But of course, that comes with the help of people helping us provide and people bringing us.
Yeah, I've been, since winter, I've been volunteering with an organization you probably know, IFAW, which is the International Fund for Animal Welfare. But out here where I am, out on the Cape, we have the animals that we take care of are marine mammals. And what's interesting about that is most of the work of a volunteer is less about the animal, although we report in about it, but mostly helping people to understand and educate them about what's going on, but also helping them not to do certain things. And if the first tendency of somebody, and I would think this happens in your same area, is to move it back to where it came from, which is a really big problem, because if the animal's sick or tired or all those things, and then, you know, that's all right. The idea is, well, let's put them back in the habitat they were in, or let's take them out and put them back in the woods. They may have crawled out for a reason.
Right.
I mean, in your case. So there may be reasons that, so people have this idea that they need to go back where they are, which is ultimately what you do. However, they may be where they are because there's something wrong or something right, but it still means you don't want to touch them. You don't want to move them.
There's a lot of detective work that goes on with this, trying to figure out what the animals can't tell us and looking to see why did they end up where they ended up? Where are their mothers and why did you end up in this situation? So yes, a lot of deciding what to do next, and it's not always put it back.
So in a way, you're also, you're acting like a pediatrician would act, where you're having to talk to the person who was the finder of the animal, right? And ferret out, well, where did you find it? What did it look like around there? You know, was it moving? I mean, you're trying to figure out and diagnose this entire, almost like doing a mystery and trying to figure out what might be going on here or what might have happened. And I'm sure that's also what you were talking about, that art of being able to talk to someone and get extract the information that they do have.
Absolutely. And sometimes people are nervous about telling us. We ask that people surrender their animals as soon as they find them. If they call, we say, don't give it food, don't give it water, keep it warm, provide some extra heat and bring it in. Sometimes people don't want to admit they maybe have already had that animal for a week, and it's trying to figure out what happened before that animal got to us and help them to see that that animal should, in order for its own welfare, to be brought in for us.
Wow. All those are amazing to me. So I would assume that people that donate, and you want people to do that to your nonprofit, a lot of that, what I would think, go to food, medicines, to cages, incubator. I mean, it goes to that stuff that, and I would think that's
it does. It goes to all of that. So 100% of donated dollars go directly to animal care. And animal care might be the food, which sounds obvious. It might be the medication. There are things that you might not think of, you know, the paper towels really do go directly to the animal care because they have to help clean. But yes, what is donated is going to go to caring for the animals that are here.
Do you get some of those supplies that you need donated? Do you get that as well?
We do. And we do different fundraisers throughout the year. In New Hampshire, there's a big fundraiser called New Hampshire Gives. On the 6th and 7th of June, there will be a big giving campaign. We participate in that and throughout the year in other events in hopes that people, even if it is a roll of paper towels, if you've been at the store and you want to pick it up, one extra something, drop it on by. We have a spot where you can leave things. What we need is not always something that costs money. Sometimes in the fall, we're asking for acorns out of your yard. We feed acorns, and there are ways to help if you're a Girl Scout troop. There are things that could be freezer burnt meat that you are going to throw away, but my carnivores are happy to eat. They don't care that it's freezer burned. So many different ways to participate in offering supplies to us. And we do talk to anyone who is willing to share their materials with us.
Yeah, what an effort on your part to coordinate all that. So you're coordinating the animals care, and you're coordinating people that are coming to you as the one that has found the animal. And then you're also coordinating a whole set of volunteers that are doing other things, including donating things. It just seems like an amazing effort. Do you have a particular story that I know you have many, but do you have a particular story about one of the volunteers and the interaction between that volunteer and an animal that really made a difference in both their lives?
Well, again, we have volunteers who regularly go above and beyond. We fairly recently, 3 weeks ago, released a North American river otter who we had here for about a year. And I think she really touched the lives of quite a number of our volunteers. When you have an animal like an otter, you don't want this animal exposed to every volunteer we have, because we needed her to know she was an otter. The plan was always to release. So there were a few key people. And I think those few key people were her otters. So my husband and I and a couple other people were there for this whole experience. And to watch them and to see two of them took her for her release. She was bundled up early in the morning and taken for a long ride to a river, but to be a part of their experience with the otter is also pretty amazing, because we learned a lot about otters. I think we learned a lot about how to care for them and each other in the process. And it was just an exciting experience for everybody to be able to watch. We had one of our volunteers, when she first got her pond, she would not go in the water. And our volunteer went in And the once it was a, you know, a 4 foot deep water enclosure, our volunteer was in the water with her.
So how do you, I'm still like really amazed. How do you know what to provide in each of these habitats and environments? Is that just that you've learned over time, or are there things that you can study that'll help you know that?
I think it's a combination of what you know about the natural history of the animal. It is what you learn from experience. The first, let's say, gray squirrel you have won't have the same experience like your children. The first child probably is raised a little differently than your third. You learn how to provide more enrichment. You learn how to provide habitat that's more natural. So it's going to conferences, it's reading, it's also reading the animal. Is that animal happy? Does that animal look like, and of course we put that emotion happy, but you can, content is in fact an emotion. You can see, are they looking to get out, or are they occupied, or it's trial and error. And what may work with one animal for a few weeks down the road, they may need something different, like a different experience, different enrichment. They're bored with the other things. We swap out our raccoon toys regularly because we want them to do different things and have more experiences.
Yeah, and we don't, I think we often don't think about that, but you're right. I mean, you know, how the role of play within animals is really critical for their development as well. And also for their rehabilitation.
It is. And they are in the natural world playing with siblings. Many of them do not do well if we have just a single one in their species. So we look amongst our rehabilitators in the state, because we're only licensed within New Hampshire. If I have a singleton, I'm looking to see if anybody else within the state has one. And we, you know, share, because it's far better for the animal, even if, you know, I have this, whatever it is, gray fox, let's say, that I want to raise. Perhaps what we do is give it to somebody else because it's better for the animal to have other siblings. So that's important. And the other piece that we have tried successfully is if we have a singleton and there are no others in that species, there have been times when I have put two different species together for a time, just because that is so important to have that heartbeat, to have that warm body, and to have somebody to snuggle up with. So we will, you know, I'm not going to put a weasel in with an eastern cottontail, but I will put different species.
Yeah, that's another amazing part of this. I've been talking with our guest, Franny Greenberg, about how she does the incredible work she does with wildlife rehabilitation. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with our guest, Franny Greenberg, about how wildlife rehabilitation effectively combines aspects of all kinds of areas, both in art and science. And Franny, I'm really curious about what you would advise somebody when they first come upon an animal that they think is injured. And I use that word think is injured because sometimes they're not. So how do they assess the scene? What do they do even before they call a rehabilitator?
I think even before you call, you want to look around. You don't want to touch an animal. You don't want to pick it up and move it. Wait first and assess. Is perhaps mom in the tree? You can always call for advice and we'll tell you about the species, but don't act as quickly as you might want to. People's hearts are in the right place and they want to help an animal, But finding a rabbit's nest in your lawn does not mean that mom has abandoned them. So wait, maybe just watch the area for a little, call a rehabilitator before moving an animal.
So I'm sussing the scene. These are the things that we talk about before you even do a human medicine out in the wilderness. So these are some skills. I would assume not getting too close to the animal is really important, because don't we stress them when we get really close?
That is quite true. And you may not even realize the animal is stressed. There are some animals, when they are stressed, they stay still. And you might think, oh, it's calm, it's relaxed. Look, it wants me to hold it. That is often stress. So you want to protect yourself in case you've come across an animal that, when you get closer, may be aggressive. An injured animal certainly can be. As you get closer, they don't know you're trying to help. For all they know, you're about to eat it for dinner. And when you get close enough, they will act out. So staying back as you're assessing is definitely good advice.
Yeah, and even having, if you've got a set of binoculars or whatever, even using those, so you can get in closer, but without physically getting in closer, so that you know more about what's going on. I've seen, I've had this happen before, and I'm sure other people have, but like even a squirrel, when it's in the heat of the summer, sometimes they will just come up on a porch, it's cool, and lie there, and they look like they're dead or sick. But after they cool down some, then they just get back up and they're active like they were again. So again, I like your idea. You don't want to overreact. That somebody could be just resting. Somebody could be chilling out.
That's right. Many animals will drape over a branch on a hot day, and given time, go about what you need to do. You go back and they're not there anymore.
What are I would think there's some legal implications too for people that I've found an animal. There are things that we can't do that we're not allowed to do as humans, because of either endangering ourselves or the animal. Do you come across those that you have to advise somebody, this is just not something that you can do, or?
There are things. First of all, to possess a wild animal, you need a license. That doesn't mean you can't take it somewhere, whether it be to a rehabilitator, or at times you found an animal that clearly needs to be euthanized. There are veterinarians that may help with that process. That you're allowed to do. But if you're keeping it, even if it's to keep it for 2 days so your grandchild can see it, or you want to show the kids at your daughter's daycare, that is not allowed. That's not legal. And that's for your own safety. There are diseases that can be transmitted to you. That's for the animal's safety. 2 days in, this animal perhaps hasn't eaten the right food. It is so stressed. There are certain animals that can actually have a heart attack and die from stress. There's cardiomyopathy, and people with good intentions thinking they're just loving the rabbit and petting the rabbit, then the rabbit has expired from human contact.
Yeah, and I think all that loving and caring comes out of are wanting to do that. At the same time, the animals are wild. They're a different species. And I think it's our tendency to think everything is like us, like humans, right? And so what would be good for a human baby is what they would think would be good for any other kind of baby. And that's where we get ourselves into trouble, is assuming that they think or act the same way. You know, oh, that thing is lonely, or, you know, that's not, those feelings are not, I don't think, what certain animals have.
The other thing we naturally want to feed and give water to animals, and that's the last thing I want anybody to do. People say it's got to be hungry. I've watched it. It's a hot day. Mom hasn't come. I can treat an animal that's dehydrated far better than I can treat an animal that's been fed the wrong food or fed in the wrong manner. But naturally, we know this, I want to do something. Let me offer it something. That, in fact, sometimes is doing more harm than good.
Yeah, and I would also say that we have the same dangers. We're out camping or we're out picnicking, and we are providing some food accidentally, but that also is maybe not necessarily a good thing either, because the nutritional content of that food is not right for that animal. Maybe not even right for us, but not certainly not right for the animal.
Yes, the raccoon may like the marshmallow you leave behind after you made s'mores, but not necessarily the best option.
I think it's all that's really amazing. So, okay, so they call you and they're ready to talk to you about what's going on. What are the things you ask them?
Often I ask for location. Sometimes I'll find this animal is exactly where it should be. So rabbits tend to choose dog pens to give birth. And they think something must be wrong. Why would a rabbit? Well, a rabbit doesn't put that much thought into it. So where is this animal? Do you see any obvious injuries? Because if it is obviously, you know, maybe it's a broken bone, maybe it's bleeding, we want to get that animal in here. So where is it? Is it injured? How is it acting? Is this an animal that's lying on its side? Is it lying on its back? What do you see? Size, as I mentioned, but that was my last item, but is we always try to get someone to tell us in relation to something standard, because we usually hear it fits in the palm of my hand, but a golf ball fits there, a tennis ball fits there, a softball fits there. So that's a tricky part sometimes, is to say, how big is it in comparison to something that you and I know exactly what it is. But nowadays we ask for pictures, because most people have a cell phone in their pocket. A photo of it will tell me a lot. It may help me determine age. It will help me determine whether or not this animal really is in need. And if they are, then we take the next steps.
And then I would assume that they can also use a video today too. That'll let you listen to the animal, see what it's doing in its movements. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that was...
No, that's fine. And videos are great too, because mobility sometimes may look off, but this is how an animal is carrying themselves. We have the opossum who may be playing dead, and they are not, but that is their defense mechanism. So we look at videos, we look at pictures, and if we determine it's time to bring an animal in, we always say, you need gloves or a barrier of some sort between your hands and that animal. Even if it's looking, it's so cute and it's fuzzy, it looks healthy, it may not be at all. And not everybody will have a pair of gloves in their car, although I will encourage everybody to have an emergency kit if you're the type of person that would stop to help. Not a bad idea to have a pair of gloves. If you don't have that, car blanket, something between you and that animal, not paper, not something that's absorbent like a paper towel. If take off your sweatshirt, take off a piece of fabric, just don't touch that animal. And that's the first important thing, because it changes our protocol depending on the animals. There are diseases we can give to animals, but there are some pretty serious things they can give to us. Rabies is fatal. And as much as our job is to care for animals, I do have to worry about the humans that have brought these animals to me. And if someone has exposed themselves to saliva or brain matter, but primarily it's saliva to an animal that's considered rabies vector, then what we need to do is we need to see whether or not they have rabies. Unfortunately, the only way to do that currently is by euthanizing the animal.
And that's right. I mean, and that's one of the hardest things for people to understand, is the only way we can determine still currently. I know people are working on other ways to be able to determine it, but we don't have a really good way other than to examine their brain. And so that's a really tough, you're right. And I hadn't thought about just saliva or the material that you might get on yourself in handling them. I would think you'd want then to be able to transfer it to something, because you don't want to put it in your car in that blanket or just put it on the seat because it might decide it's going to move. And then you've got a really compounding problem with something that goes under the seat or hides.
It's been more than one time that my husband has had to fish animals out from under a car seat when the animal was calm when they left the scene, but active by the time they got here.
And I can't imagine a car ride for an animal, what that would be like.
Right. We tell people too, while you're driving, leave the radio off. This is not the time to bring the dog in the car, try to have a quiet ride.
Yeah. Do you advise them to put it in something if they have a container or something?
Yes, a container is always advisable, whether it be an Amazon box, and we all have those lying around, a cat carrier, a dog crate, depending on the size, but contain it so that you know when you get here, it's still contained.
Wow. Oh, so many things for us to think about in that. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you to explore further with your family and with friends in conversation, any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show. And we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with our guest, Franny Greenberg, about the ways that she works to rehabilitate wildlife. And so we talked earlier about how it isn't just curing the disease or raising it, but it's also being able to actually reintroduce it back into the wild. And I think it's interesting in your job, and I know that I know my wife as a veterinarian faces this too, that people really do want to have, you know, regular, after they've had the experience, emotional experience, they want regular updates. And they don't understand, even in a veterinarian's office, that may not be possible to have an immediate update. Like if there are other emergencies that come in, and that's built around a money kind of thing, where you guys are all volunteering and you have so many animals. So I think people understanding that might be an unreal expectation to have regular updates on something when you're trying to care for all the animals, what's going on behind the scenes.
We do ask for understanding. We do our best. We let people contact us after 24 hours. We can let them know, did the animals survive? Are we feeling positive? Did something happen? But the daily updates with photos, unfortunately, we would need a full-time staff person to do that. So we do encourage people to look at our social media pages. We try to post something every day, and they may see their animal there. But it also becomes difficult. We, at times, will have 30 baby bunnies. We group them by age. There comes a time after we know they're healthy and they go with a group. Your bunny may be one of 12. I'm no longer sure which your bunny is. But yes, we ask for understanding that our goal is the animal's welfare. We'd love to give you those updates, but it's more important that we take the time to give them what they need.
What they need. So that brings up, you just mentioned something that's an interesting question in my head, and that is, how do you determine the age of a bunny?
Well, part of it is, do they have fur? We look to see if their eyes are open. We look to see if their ears are up, and then their size. A bunny that is the size of a tennis ball, which seems pretty small, is a bunny that's on its own. Mom has stopped nursing, so it would have its eyes open, ears up, be fully fluffy, and then we would say that bunny is probably around the age of 4 weeks, and you should leave that bunny where it is.
That's just really, it's so fun to go through all these things. Back to an earlier topic that we just brushed over briefly, and I think it's fairly important, and that is a lot of things happen with our environment and with humans that where we, you know, we create changes in the habitat for something, which changes patterns for certain things. And I know people have really been upset, like with deer, and not understanding that, you know, they maybe go into their garden and what's happening with them. Coyotes is a big one in cities even, and they have adapted themselves well. So have raccoons. I mean, there's certain things that have adapted really well to being around people. But I think people struggle with understanding that that's because something has happened to interrupt their normal, when they would prefer to be somewhere else. But it's barely been disrupted in that way. You find that in your work?
Yes, and we try to get people to coexist with the animals that are in their yard. If they suddenly are coming in, there are ways to live with a lot of these animals, and we try to get them to appreciate why all of a sudden you will now have an increased number of rabbits. And we look at populations. Is it a heavy predator year, a heavy prey year? So we do have people who are concerned with the animals in their yard. We have a lot of calls. People would like us to take the woodchucks so they don't eat their garden. That's not a service we provide. We're here for injured or orphans. We don't just come out and trap. We don't relocate. We're happy to educate, happy to talk to you about what you need over your garden and let you know woodchucks climb and they will go up and over your fence. But we cannot take animals out of their habitat. We want to teach you instead how to live with them.
How to live with them, or how to do that differently. So you've got, you say mammals. Did you also include bats in that?
A bat is a mammal, so we do take them. We have most of them over winter. We find that they're in people's attic. They're in people's homes, and hibernation is disturbed. They may come down with a Christmas ornament. Somebody opens them up. Now we have a warm bat who is flying around. So we put those bats back into hibernation. We keep them till it's time and there are mosquitoes. Over winter, we can feed them some here, but we like to keep them as close as they can be to what would be happening in the wild.
That's really interesting. I had no idea about that. And that's really... that you would try to reintroduce the natural cycle of a hibernation, or at least a slowed metabolism, so that they don't have to feed, which is why they go into it, which people also don't understand. And I think the other one is, and you mentioned that well, but is if you have a professional service to be able to remove that animal, you also have to think about, well, how did it get in? And you need to make sure that you're not part of the problem in continuing to have an entry point, so that this has to keep re-traumatizing the animal and yourselves.
Yes, and there are wildlife control companies that work humanely. I encourage everyone, if you are going to have someone come to your home, know where the animal that they have excluded, and if exclusion is different than relocating, know what happened. A good wildlife control company has a wildlife rehabilitator that they work with to understand the natural history, to figure out how to do it safely. To get the animal to move out on their own is usually the primary goal.
Yeah, opening a door.
Yes.
I've often found that you can open a door and a bat will go out if it's flying around in there eventually. Yes. You just have to wait. Birds the same way. They will eventually get out. But people do get all worried about them. Or bothered by them, one or the other. You're right. Are you seeing, though, an increase in stress on any of the mammals and stuff because of climate change?
We have a change in patterns for definitely. When we see the animals starting to come, it used to be March would be our first babies. We had a baby porcupine come in January this year. So cycles are off. We're definitely seeing a change. And sometimes we see two litters a year and an animal that would normally have just one litter a year. So it is changing.
so interesting, all this. I want to thank you so much, Franny, for being with us and helping us navigate through really what is a wonderful service you provide, but also the art form that you provide in doing that, the art of caring and loving and intuition, as well as the science behind that. Thank you so much. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.